welcome back to another exciting episode of the Captain America Minute, where we examine the 2011 Joe Johnston-directed feature, Captain America, the First Avenger, at the rate of 1 minute of screen time per episode. I'm one of your hosts just a few miles from Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. This is Jim O'Kane of TVDads.com.
And I'm Hal Bryan, an airplane nerd from the home of the Experimental Aircraft Association here at Oshkosh, Wisconsin.
And I'm Brian Fees, a graphic novelist and lifelong Avengers comic book reader.
Well, it's closing time. You don't have to go home, but you can't stay here. Let's check in on Steve and Peggy in that that poor little pub.
Yes, that delightful pub in minute 92. In the bombed out pub in central London, Steve Rogers locks eyes with Peggy Carter, his voice resolute. I'm not going to stop until all of Hydra is dead or captured. Peggy meets his gaze. You won't be alone. At the Strategic Scientific Reserve headquarters, Colonel Phillips stands before a map of Europe and North America, addressing Steve, Peggy, Howard Stark, and the Howling Commandos seated around a conference table. Johann Schmidt belongs in a bug house. He thinks he's a god, and he's willing to blow up half the world to prove it, starting with the USA. Howard leans forward, his tone grave. Schmidt's working with powers beyond our capabilities. He gets across the Atlantic, he will wipe out the entire eastern seaboard in an hour. Gabe Jones looks up, tense. How much time we got? According to my new best friend, under 24 hours, Phillips replies. Falsworth frowns. Where is he now? Phillips taps a surveillance photo. Hydra's last base is here, in the Alps, 500 feet below the surface. Jim Morita shakes his head. So what are we supposed to do? I mean, it's not like we can just knock on the front door. Steve's eyes glint with determination. Why not? The team turns to him, surprised. That's exactly what we're going to do. The scene shifts to a foggy forest at dawn. Steve, in his Captain America uniform, revs his motorcycle along a tree-lined path, his vibranium shield slung over his back, speeding toward danger with unwavering resolve.
Such a great minute. A bunch
so
of
much
things
good stuff happening
on
in this. Yeah.
Yeah. I want to point out, I want to put on my film theory hat and point out the dichotomy, if you can use that word, of the first scene where, as we're finishing up the pub scene, and as we go into the, I guess the staff meeting scene, which takes up most of this minute, in telling the story cinematically, and Brian, or in comic books too, there are methods that you use. And we've had this back since the days of William S. Porter. There are two forms you can do. You can do omniscient, which is that opening scene in the pub where we're looking down on these two characters in the abandoned pub, or you can go to subjective, where you're part of the action. So you're drawn into this action with a lot of close-ups, but you're the height of the camera and the motions back and forth. There's no tilting. There's just panning left and right. You are a member of the Howling Commandos, and you are sitting there in the meeting, watching all these people making decisions. So, welcome to the staff meeting. It's fascinating that, I mean, our brain doesn't notice it, but we understand the language behind it.
Yeah, it's right. A great note, and particularly since the very last scene we have in the pub is that elevated shot of Peggy and Steve and the pub all destroyed, and then we go right to this much more intimate scene of, as you say, you are sitting at the table with these people.
And that omniscient view, gives us that, we know what we're seeing is important, but, and it's not like it's an uncomfortable scene to watch by any stretch of the imagination, but that viewpoint sort of reminds you, sort of just be quiet, be respectful, but, you should, or maybe you really shouldn't be, eavesdropping on these people and what they're doing, but you know that it's important, you know that you have to, so you're just going to be there for a bit. And then, as you say, then we switch right into, now I'm at the table. And Jim, I'd like to thank you for fulfilling a lifelong dream of mine and telling me that I'm one of the Howling Commandos. Now I heard you say it.
That's right.
Just by watching the movie.
You're going to have to get a bowler and get your chevrons on a bowler, and you'll be fine.
All I can say is Wahoo.
To Jim's point, it's an excellent point, because I'm kind of scrubbing through the scene in the briefing room, and we never see an establishing shot of this room. We don't get any kind of a wide shot of this. It's very right up in everybody's faces and backs, and the whole thing is shot as if you were about, you know, three and a half feet off the ground, like you're sitting in a chair. You're looking up at Phillips's back. You're looking across at everybody's faces. That camera is seated at this table, and it never wavers from that point of view. It's a great, great note, Jim.
Yeah, it's something once you think about it, it becomes very obvious. But in the moment, which just gives you an idea about Joe's mastery of understanding how people think when they're watching a movie without having to beat it into your head that no, this is you know, it's not like a first person shot. You're not watching like you're playing a video game. You're a part of their world. And people like Hitchcock relied on this a lot. If you think back to the scene in North by Northwest, the famous crop duster scene, that whole scene starts omnisciently with a bus pulling up at a bus stop, and Cary Grant getting off the bus. So we watch it from a high angle, and then as the bus pulls away, we're at the height of Cary Grant as he watches the bus go off toward the endless, you know, cornfields in the distance. And as the crop duster arrives from the far distance, you are suddenly, you know, latched on to Cary Grant. Even when he's being shot at with machine guns, he falls down on the ground, and you're on the ground with Cary Grant. And that subjective scene only ends when he steals a passerby their pickup truck, and he goes off in the distance, and you're left behind with the people watching the crashed airplane. So, you know, I think Joe, I know Joe went to film school after, you know, George Lucas sent him to film school because he wanted to be a director. And I think Joe picked up all these clues. And plus, I mean, Joe's quite an aficionado on films and how they work. So
absolutely.
It's great seeing this kind of artistry in a motion picture.
And Jim, I'd be remiss as a quick tangent if I did not point out, you know, you and I did a week of the North by Northwest Minute as guest hosts, and of course we talked to the gentleman who owns that airplane at N3N. It is now, as of July 2nd, 2026, that airplane has been for sale for a little while. It is now down to $75,000. If anybody wants
a steal,
wants an N3N, it was
machine
just
gun not included. Yeah,
it belongs in a museum.
It belongs to Coronado. Oh wait, strike that. Reverse it.
Something else I noticed about the staff meeting scene I wanted to bring up is that all the good guys are there. When Peggy, the last thing Peggy says is, "You won't be alone." And we switch to this scene where all the good guys, to my memory, at the first time in this movie, are united around the table. To this point, you know, Phillips has been kind of working on his thing. The Howling Commandos have been doing their thing. Captain America's been doing his thing. Stark's been doing his thing. But now they're all gathered around the table. It's kind of like, almost like Avengers Assemble, you know? And this is the scene in Star Wars where they're planning their assault on the Death Star.
Yes.
You know, the forces of good have united, and they're putting together a plan.
Yeah. You know, speaking about that point of view, and you know, we truly have a seat at the table. It's intriguing to me that, that, you know, that happens, and we're somebody at the table, but at the 50-51 second mark, the camera shifts. It's from Cap's point of view. So at that instant, I don't know about you guys, but I am Captain America right then. And everybody's looking at me to explain this plan, and, you know, sitting there thinking, this is really cool, but maybe the real Steve Rogers should take it from here. Don't rely on me to justify this, but it's a great sense, and so beautifully choreographed, all those heads just turning and looking, you know, with that. Okay. What do you mean? We're just going to knock on the front door.
I've freeze framed that second. And it's interesting that the actors aren't looking right down the barrel of the camera. They're looking a little like what I would think of as behind the camera. They're looking, at Steve, you know, and Steve's effectively holding the camera here. It's interesting, because if they were looking at the camera, they'd be looking at us, the audience members, but they're not looking at us. They're looking at Steve.
That's true. Yeah.
Yeah.
So maybe I'm not Captain America, but I'm still Howling Commando.
You might want to talk to your therapist about some of these transference issues you're having. This need for heroism, but
as soon as I get out of the Vita-Ray machine, I'll give him a call.
But it is, Jim. Again, great point. All I can do is reinforce what you've already said, which is Joe Johnson really understands language of film in this scene, and second by second, you can look at it and just say, why did he do that shot? And the answer to that question always makes sense and moves the story forward.
And we know from so many other movies that Joe firmly believes in storyboarding, because it's a lot cheaper to figure it out on a piece of paper than setting up a Panavision vision camera and all the tracks to move that camera around. So you can almost see this as a comic book. I mean, you could see each shot that this is what it would look like on page 17. And it's remarkable how much that carries over between the two media.
You know who else was a big storyboarder? Hitchcock.
Yep. That's right.
Oh, sure.
He actually said that filming a movie bored him because he already knew what it looked like.
Yeah.
One other thing about these sort of the POVs and the camera angles is, when we see that shot from sort of Steve's POV, but Brian, you're quite right to point out, they're actually looking past and behind the camera. Then we switch and we're looking up at Steve, and it's interesting to me that, Steve is seated. Everybody behind him is taller. But where we are, we're looking up at Steve, and somehow, even though it's not sort of physically true, he's the tallest person in the room, even though he's the only one in that frame sitting down. There's just no question of who is the dominant figure here. And you would, I think, an amateur might look at this and say, well, those guys have to sit down and Steve's got to stand up so we can be looking way up at him and he can be imposing, but he's got all the presence he needs. He's got all the presence in the world and just owns that shot without having to stand up.
Great shot. And I'm looking at it and it almost evokes some of the principles of Renaissance perspective painting and drawing. I mean, Steve is framed by this perfect arch around him. The lights form kind of an arch around him and give him kind of a halo. The shapes of the men, the sizes of men around him, all the lines of perspective point right at Steve. There's kind of a white wall off to the right. All those lines lead right to Steve, the middle of Steve's head. Everything in this shot focuses just on Steve. If you've ever looked at, we all know what Da Vinci's Last Supper looks like. If you've ever looked at Leonardo da Vinci's Last Supper, every line in that composition leads directly to Jesus. And I'm not comparing Steve Rogers to Jesus, but it's the same kind of composition here. Everything in this picture leads right to the center of Steve's face.
Yeah, this also follows Tolan's rules. Greg Tolan was the cinematographer for Citizen Kane, and he had rules about where your eye goes in a frame when you're looking at it. He said your eye goes to light, and it goes to motion, then it goes to the upper right-hand side of the frame to get clues as to what you should be looking at. So if you look at this, the light is shining down on Steve. Steve's head is the only thing that moves. Everybody else is perfectly still. His head is the only thing in motion, and his body is the only thing that's changing shape as the camera pushes in. And if you look in the upper right-hand side, the soldier in the upper right-hand side, the only thing he's doing is looking right back at Steve, pointing back to that center of action.
Yeah. Wow. It's a great composition.
Brilliant.
And I really like that tie shirt combo that, the light tie with the dark shirt. That's always works well. But I have to tell you, I do have a major jealousy. I want Dum Dum Dugan's sweater. That is one heck of a sweater. That just, it really bulks him up, but it's a great looking sweater. I don't think it's Army regulation, although none of them are wearing regulation anything.
Yeah, it looks comfy.
I think Falstaff is roughly regulation for like a British para with his his cravat and everything else. But looking at Dum Dum's sweater, and he's got a Are they just suspenders, or is he? He doesn't
I
have
think
any kind of
like
a
suspenders.
hat on. I
think they're suspenders. It's almost like lederhosen or something. That's, you know, like
Right.
I don't know what he's holding up, or it might be. Is he strapped? Is that like, you know, I don't know
Could be
if it's
weapons.
holding
Could be
pistols.
hip waders, I think. I think they're hip waders. I think he's going fishing.
And I wish I could get a better look at it too. So he's got that nice heavy turtleneck with the you know, medium and dark stripes across it. But on his left, he does have a little patch on his left shoulder that's giving it a little bit more of a uniform look. And I'm wondering, is that just another SSR thing? It's not really shaped like it. It looks a little bit more Superman shield shaped, but
And of course Stark is wearing the regulation zoot suit for he's got that double-breasted thing that it looks a little big for him. It looks I don't know if that I mean I understand at the time the sartorial preferences of the early 40s was to have an oversized suit. I mean
yeah,
not, you know,
baggy was
right.
in.
Yeah, not Talking Heads level
I
of,
was
you
just gonna say, no David
know.
Byrne, but close.
Yeah, it's
Yeah.
a it is pretty awesome sized thing. I have to apologize. My wife always talks about these kinds of podcasts when we're talking about individual seconds about what we're seeing and what we're looking at in the background. She said, "Now I'm going to have to go watch the movie again." Well, that's the whole point. You got to go watch the movie. Tune to just spin ahead to minute 92, and you can follow along with what we're talking
I
about.
do kind of worry about listeners saying, "Yeah, damn, I got to watch number minute in a second 53 of minute 92." It's like,
Yeah,
geez
what are
whiz.
all those peacocks in the
But
back? I don't understand why they're waving. And
but you know, I think these are things. If nothing else, on future viewings, a listener could say, "Man, I kind of see what those guys were talking about." They don't have to dissect it, but
right.
I think once in a while we'll come up with a gem that will improve somebody's enjoyment of the film.
If we get to the end of this, all 100 and some odd episodes, and somebody says, "I don't ever want to see that movie again," we've probably done something horribly wrong.
Yeah, that's I'm going to bang on something I always bang on about, which is color palette and the shift from this briefing room honey colored palette to an immediate cut to this omniscient blue forest that we find ourselves in as Steve roaring down the road. And I've just got to give a nod. Steve on this motorcycle is one of those images that's just ripped right out of the comic books from my brain, from my 15-year-old brain, and put on the screen. It's thrilling to see Steve roaring down the road on this motorbike, and particularly puts me in mind of artwork done by an artist named Jim Steranko, who was drawing Captain America's adventures in the 60s, maybe early 70s too. And man, he loved to put Steve on a motorbike and have him roaring down the highway. And this just looks like a Steranko drawing to me.
Yeah, it's beautiful. I mean, with the siren and the blackout light on the front with the shotgun, the shotgun carefully stored there so he can just whip it out at full speed. As we'll get into a future minute,
And the
but
camera is down at ground level. There's a split second of Steve starting the bike, kick starting the bike, and the camera's got to be 2 inches off the ground. And then he comes roaring down the road, and the camera again is just right on the ground. So Steve looks huge and heroic. Probably looks like he's going a lot faster than he is. It's just a great shot.
yeah, and that one long panning shot is an old trick from I think Joe's Lucasfilm days, because the Lucasfilm loves having a scene where you can expand the horizontal by having something coming and going. And when we see the motorcycle, it's a beautiful representation of that. You have the I mean they do that in Empire Strikes Back. You'll see it with the Millennium Falcon. You see it with TIE fighters and things like that. But here you see the motorcycle come at you. The camera starts panning right, and then Steve goes off in the distance. So we get a real feeling. The panorama of that forest gets thrown into your brain without having to make, you know, a Cinerama as the format.
That's beautiful. The action almost goes from horizon to horizon, like, you know, western horizon to eastern horizon or whichever direction he's going. It's a beautiful shot.
No, it's this is
And
all
then you
just
know
a
what? And the very last thing we see as he disappears into the right side of the screen is that shield on his back. It's just, you know, if there were any doubt who that is, he's got the shield on his back.
And there's something so satisfying to me about a shot like that, that has such a clear and defined a beginning and a middle and an end. You know, there's a conclusion to it. You could just, like, if Joe had cut this scene 2 seconds earlier, you know, Cap is most of the way across, but is you know, maybe three quarters of the way through or something like that. Most of us would look at that and not know why we didn't like it, but it would be jarring. It would be strange. We want that satisfying. He's over there. He's going to go past us. Now he goes out over there, and it's in a very, very simple, you know, sort of macro way. It's a story.
I rides motorcycle
from left to right.
And I think there's also some relief because, as we were talking earlier, we have been cooped up with these people in this briefing room. We've been right in their faces. And then all of a sudden we're in a forest, and it's a big forest with a lot of room to spread out.
Yeah. And you can almost feel the coolness or not only the color palette, but it's a cool day in, you know, and you're up in the Alps somewhere, and it's the opposite of that stuffy, which probably would have been smoke filled room that they were having the meeting in. So it definitely is a contrast. I do have to point out an unspoken moment of the story that we didn't get to there. As we're panning through the different people sitting at the table, in the background we notice a clerk sitting behind Agent Carter, and that is not Natalie Dormer. So I was wondering if Agent Carter had reassigned that private to somewhere in Siberia or, you know, the Aleutian Islands as a monitoring station. And so it's like, let's get a different clerk in here besides Natalie.
A good point.
That's a great point.
I hadn't thought about it. I kind of assumed it was her because it's, you know, it's a young blonde woman, but it's not her.
Yes.
It's interesting.
I can see Agent Carter not announcing that. It's just, she just suddenly had some personnel reassignments.
Well, the SSR is a big place. She's probably working in a different room.
Sure.
They've got a lot of openings. There's a lot of room for at least lateral movement, if not actual growth.
Yeah. Off to Alamogordo. Yeah. Here you're going to probably escorting Dr. Zola.
To Alamogordo.
Alamogordo.
And, you know, Jim, since you took us back to that spot, I hadn't noticed this before, but you see a bit of a chalkboard sign there. And you say aircraft casualties, aircraft enemy destroyed, probable damage. And that's very much, you know, air combat nomenclature, very much British RAF nomenclature from the war. That idea of keeping track of, you know, an enemy that's truly destroyed, that's confirmed. A probable means, you know, something like the last time I saw it was on fire and it was going down, but you don't know for certain. And then, you know, somebody else is reporting, well, we shot up this enemy bomber and it was definitely damaged, but it was still flying when we left. And you would see those chalkboard kind of scoreboards, and you would see, of course, the giant tables with the almost like the pool cues moving the pieces around, like the tabletop gaming we've talked about. But that's an interesting thing there, and an interesting sort of crossover into aerial operations. So it kind of has me curious. It's like what's the crossover there with the SSR and the RAF?
Yeah, I mean, there's probably intelligence gathering. They're going up with camera crews. I was wondering if there's any significance to where it says London red and London white on the on that same chalkboard.
Oh, I'm not seeing.
It's the 24.
Oh, gotcha. I was looking much, much later if I could see the other half of it. That's a good question. My first thought was whether or not that would have anything to do with this. So the RAF used these color-coded sector clocks so that you had repeating colors around the full circle of a clock. And they used that to keep track of any time they would update the positions of, say, enemy and friendly aircraft on one of those boards. It would be tied to a certain color, so you knew that this change happened at, you know, it was either 7 minutes after the hour or 14 or 28, you know, whatever those intervals were. So it's the only thing that's immediately coming to mind with the colors, but I'm not sure if that would tie in here at all or not, especially with just two colors.
The only thing I could conclude from that is you guys have much better monitors than I do, because I can't see a damn thing. I can't read that at all.
I was just, you know, I'm trying to figure out if there was, and in late 1943, which this is late 1943, how many were there lots of Luftwaffe raids going on that late in the game? I was, I mean, I'm picturing mean, this being much earlier.
Yeah, certainly not like, I mean, obviously not like what you had had during the Blitz. You know, once the, you know, the Churchill's famous speech about at the in late 1940, you know, the Battle of Britain is over, and the, or I guess that was early. Forgive me, I got that backwards. Battle of France is over. The Battle of Britain had begun. So strike that. Yeah. But you know, once the, you know, the Germans were pretty much stopped at the channel to a degree. It's not that they weren't still sending bombers over, but that initial blitz, everything scaled way back as we started taking the fight more to them.
Yeah, I mean, they were still doing, you know, there were V2 bombings, but I didn't think there were many aerial attacks or aerial, you know, I mean, we pretty much owned the skies by late 1943. But yeah, maybe it's just an old chalkboard that they parked it in the meeting room. It's like, we're not going to use this. This could be
very well could be
two year old. Yeah, yeah. Just in case anybody wants to write down secret information, they can put it up on that board. Wow.
Well, it's a nice bit of set dressing that adds some texture to the piece. I mean, nobody in the theater was looking at that chalkboard, but it's there, and it gives you some verisimilitude.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. Joe would probably roll his eyes if we started asking questions like that. It looks nice. It's in the background. Don't worry about it. So anyway, well, if you've got ideas on this particular minute, we would love to hear from you. We're always available over there at Camp Lehigh, the Captain America Minute listeners base on Facebook. It's getting a little bit of response out there lately. If you do like our show, don't forget to subscribe, please, and leave a like at the podcast streaming service where you found this episode. Also, please check out our great big website, capminute.com, for the latest about our podcast topics and guests. And be sure to join us here next time on the Captain America Minute.
I can do this all day.